Hi, everybody. Welcome, welcome back. It's our first meeting of Pirkei Avot, History and Hashkafah since the Chagim. Hard to believe we have a whole week. We have a whole week to use and no Chagim, no nothing, just straight time. And in fact, I was thinking about it, that it's not inappropriate that the Mishnah that we're going to discuss today actually, I think, relates directly to the challenge posed by the month of Mar Cheshvan. Let me explain. We have just gone through, everybody according to the degree of the intensity of they experience the High Holy Days and the holidays afterwards. Really something on the order of almost 2 months worth of immersion or awareness of a special dimension of life. The month of Elul, in a very real sense, Rabbi Soloveitchik always used to say, and you don't need him for that, actually. The month of Elul is a prep for the High Holidays, so move yourself out of the summer, and you started getting ready for the High Holidays and all that they signify. And it gets more and more intensive as time goes on, and the Ashkenazim especially, they only start in the beginning blowing shofar, and then only start saying slichot, the penitential prayers, towards the end of the month. So it starts building up. The Sephardim sort of jump into it, Mizrachim jump into it right away by blowing shofar and doing slichot in the beginning, because perhaps it's a topic for another occasion. The modality of Mizrahi spirituality is different than that of Ashkenazim. Anyways, both traditions, start building up and you get to Rosh Hashanah, and then it gets more and more intense. I mean, Rosh Hashanah is half holiday, half holy day. And then the 10 days of penitence build up until you get to Yom Kippur. You get to the heights, and in the heights, we are transformed. I mean, the way that tradition sees it, we're transformed into angels. We become angelic beings. That's why it's a custom to wear white on Yom Kippur. You're enveloped. You sort of withdraw from the world. In the old days, In pre-modern times, people would actually go to shul and not come back until after the fast was over. Some people stay up all night. I know we live for the sacred break in the tefillot, so we can catch a few hours of sleep and get through the fast. But we're not made of the same metal as our forebears. In any event, the Yom Kippur reaches a height, and you're immersed in sanctity, you're immersed in light, the images of light and praise and pure spirituality and angelic being are truly, overwhelming. And then at the end of Yom Kippur, there is this beginning of a letdown. You blow shofar, and there is this idea that God's, the intensity of the plenitude of God's presence, it gets somewhat lessened, weakened. And then you go into Sukkot. Sukkot is a festival in a very, very real way of the happy and successful resolution of the process that started on Rosh Chodesh Elul. In other words, we're celebrating Yom Kippur. We're celebrating that we hope that God really forgave us, and we're having no opportunity. But the sukkah itself is a funny kind of animal. First of all, what it symbolizes, you'll see in a minute why what this has to do with the Mishnah. The sukkah, there is a famous point of dispute between the second century sages, Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Eliezer, as to what do the sukkot denote. Seemingly, it's a non-starter. I mean, what do you mean? What do they symbolize? They symbolize, tents. That's how the Kibasukot Toshavti B'nei Yisrael Meretz Mitzrayim. I brought God says, I took you out in you know, collapsible tents. What's to break your head over? And that's what Rabbi Eliezer says. What are you talking about? We're reliving history, which is, as I've told you on many occasions, I mean, that's a permanent moment in Jewish religious and national memory, where we sort of act out, not in a bad sense, but, reenact, re-experience past events, because the past in Jewish memory is fluid. Rabbi Akiva didn't like that. He said, nah, that's not it. What is it? It is the Ananea Kavod. The sukkah embodies, represents, reminds us of the fact that when the Jews were in the desert, they were surrounded by God's presence, by the clouds of glory. Clouds of glory. What's that? It's sort of a tangible sense of, despite the fact you're out in the world, you're out in the desert. I mean, the desert is really sort of like nowhere, right? I argue, by the way, that airport terminals are also nowhere, but that's another kind of nowhere. And anyway, the idea is that you're out in the outside and you're encompassed by God's presence. So it's interesting. In other words, that's an interesting continuity from Yom Kippur, because in Yom Kippur you're also sort of like this immersion in sanctity and being surrounded by light and so on. And Sukkot, but that's in Shul. Here you're out in the world. And you have sort of like this experience on the one hand of being outside and being exposed and yet being protected. And then Sukkot is over. Okay, you go back in the house and you celebrate the Torah and so on. And then there's nothing. Nothing. Cheshvan blank, gornished. Nada, niente. Nonche niente. There's absolutely nothing. Nothing there. No holidays. No, well, there are different explanations why there's no holiday in Cheshvan. Some people say we need a break. Other people will say that it's sort of like that the rabbis were careful not to make holidays and not to assign holidays to Cheshvan because Yerav Jeroboam, who split the Jewish community, he split the tribes of Israel, he led the great revolt against Rehavam and set up the 10 tribes and put up golden calves in Beit El and in Dan. His central holiday that he made everybody go to for his idols was in Cheshvan, so Cheshvan is off limits. And yet there are those who say, on the other hand, that you need 1 month with no holidays because that's the holiday, that's when the Mashiach's going to come. Which has got all kinds of implications, but not for now. Let's go with the fact that there's nothing there. It's Cornish. Because you need a break. Or maybe it's more than that. And maybe I'd like to suggest, and now we come to the Mishnah, it only took me 8 minutes. Maybe the process that starts at in Elul gets put to the test in Cheshvan. What do I mean? We worked up this whole period of almost two full months, really 7 weeks of holidays and sanctity and self introspection and repentance and commitment to change, all kinds of stuff. And now the Torah sort of says, okay, let's see you do it. Let's see you imagine you're in a sukkah, that's sort of like the atmosphere that you lived in during this entire 7 week period. You can actually take it with you into the big world, into the real world. I would even take it one step further, that in light of that it's not inappropriate, therefore, to celebrate the conclusion and the restart of the reboot, if you want, of the reading of the Torah on the last day of Sukkot, because basically from a Jewish point of view, the directions for how to navigate Cheshvan are really it's really the Torah. Okay, now what has that got to do? Now we come to the Mishnah. The Mishnah that we had been discussing before Rosh Hashanah is attributed to Hillel HaZaken, to the Hillel the Elder. It is chapter 2, Mishnah 5. And just to remind you, so Hillel here had been listing a whole bunch of personality types, like, you know, if you're like this, you can't do this. If you can't, if you really have to, things that you have to fix to be able to achieve something else. So a person who is a boor, we discussed that at length, can't be God-fearing or can't be sin-fearing. A person who is an ignoramus can't really be pious. A person who is shy really can't really learn. A teacher who is overly strict and overly punctilious can never really be an effective teacher. And the one we're up to now is v'lo kol ha-marbe b'schara machkim. And not anyone who, not a person who is marbe b'schara, a person who is, spends too much time in business, can't really become wise. Now, let's assume for a minute that machkim only means, it's very long, I mean, look, people have experience, people gain, they become wise in the ways of the world, they become wise in the ways of business, they become wise in the ways of their profession. So to say that a person who is a businessman, who's, you know, really is very much involved in his trade, in his profession, in his practice, whatever the case might be, doesn't mean he's an idiot. Machkim here means wisdom in the higher sense, meaning you can't be a Talmid Chacham. Okay. Now, it's interesting. I call your attention to a couple of things. It doesn't say, Mehillah doesn't say, lo kol ha-mit asek baschora machkim. It doesn't say somebody who's in business can't become a wise person. Why? All he says, marbet, you overdo it. We'll see what that means. Because, again, we're coming back to this. This is an issue of tension which constantly arises throughout Pirkei Avot. We've seen it so many different times. How do you balance this world and the other? How do you balance spiritual concerns, religious concerns, things that belong to the next world, and your requirements and your responsibilities and your religious responsibility, your religious obligations to live in this world? That's the challenge of Cheshvan. Because we've been on, and that's what I'm trying to say. And Elul and Tishrei sort of gives you, what's the word I'm looking for? Training wheels. The Sukkah is training wheels and living outside. Here, now you're on your own. And the question is, how are you going to balance it? Schora you must do. Business you must do. But not too much. Kol hamarbe bischora. Lo ham kol hamarbe bischora. You overdo it. Interestingly, the rabbis, when they rephrase this on a number of occasions, say that the people, the Torah is never found among sachranim and tagranim. It doesn't say, the word for merchants are socharim and tagarim. Those are the proper words. So what's a tagran? What's a sachran? That's a person who's totally compartmentalized, but that's all he does. He's totally involved in business, 24/7. I'm saying 24/7. He might not be doing business on Shabbat if he shomer Shabbat, but his head is still in the office. There's a difference between a socher and a sachran. A socher is a guy who he's a business person. A tagar is a person who's a merchant who travels from place to place and sells things. Actually, a peddler. A sachran is a person. That's his essence. He's essentially a business person. Can't think about anything else. A tagran is a person who's every waking, maybe not even waking, maybe when he's sleeping too, is devoted to thinking about business concerns. That kind of person can never become wise. Why? Because it's overwhelming. I mean, the observation is clearly, the observation by itself is clearly, it's almost self-evident. If you only do one thing, then you can't do something else. I have a friend who's a himself as something, as a guy who's achieved a tremendous amount. He has three doctorates. He's a doctor. He's a physiologist. He does medical research and all kinds of stuff. But I'll never forget that he once, at his son's bar mitzvah, he mentioned, he says, you know, every time you make a choice, every time you choose a path, you close a door. You know, so if you're going to devote yourself 150% to your business, then you're not going to have time to learn. I mean, that's an obvious, that's so self-evident. But I don't think that that's what Hillel here is in mind. What his point is, I think his point is that business has a tendency, outside concerns have a tendency, to be all-consuming. They have a tendency to be all-consuming, both emotionally as well as just practically. Emotionally, because the more you make, the more you're involved, business has a tendency, we have to, a friend of mine pointed out to me a long time ago that if businesses don't grow, then they die. So since businesses have to grow, then they'll draw you in. I mean, it's very simple. You want your practice to be bigger and your needs get bigger so it's a normal thing. So it's a very, very hard thing to do, to learn how to put on the brakes. And so, in fact, now comes the question of compartmentalization. Not to get carried away, as my father-in-law used to say. Lo kolam arbeh b'schora machkim. If religious growth is a value, and your learning and your Torah study, in the broad sense, is a value, then you have to be aware of the seductive nature of other activities. I don't think I really have to go into details. I think everybody here is very well aware of the fact that how this dynamic works. On the other hand, it's really striking that as a sub theme of the commentaries that run through here, they're always there's almost an ironic explanation that they add, an ironic dimension that they add to the interpretation and the understanding of Hillel's statement. They quote a verse at the end of the Torah, which I think we actually discussed, but I don't remember, and I didn't have time to go through listening through. I don't like to listen to myself, so you'll have to excuse me. The Torah says at the end of Parshat Vayelech that the Torah is not in heaven, as if to say, go, we have to go to heaven to go get another Torah or go get it. It's right here. And it's also not at the other end of the seas. It's not if you're sitting in Eretz Yisrael, it's not in Spain, it's not in China, it's not wherever, it's not in America. You know, it's accessible. You don't have to travel a long way to go. Now, the point of the verse, and that's how it's invoked usually, is to say that the Torah is right there for you. All you have to do is to really just reach out and make the commitment to study Torah. Okay, very nice. The Talmud, and more interestingly, the many of the commentaries, the medieval commentaries in particular, but the truth of the matter is that it's not really, that it's certainly appropriate for contemporary life as well. Lo me'ever layam, they say, the Torah is not me'ever layam. In other words, if you have to travel for business, you might as well forget about ever becoming a Talmud Chacham. You might as well forget about studying Torah. Because most merchants, especially in the Middle Ages, when they would go away, they'd go away for years. But, you know, the truth of the matter is, even people that commute to their jobs in Europe or in America or in Israel or whatever the case might be, it's exhausting, and travel is exhausting. And the assumption is that if you have to run around like a crazy person, then you're not going to, like a fasamta mois, my mother would say, a drugged mouse, you're not going to have time to have the composure to be able to study. Now, the truth of the matter is that there's a lot to that. Travel is exhausting. I haven't been out of Israel in over 2 years. It's very strange because I didn't travel a lot, but I traveled a fair amount before Corona. And the truth of the matter is, without running around, there's a lot more time, a lot more composure to be able to do things of a more rarefied nature. Anyways. The point is that the that nevertheless, this objection may not be relevant anymore, at least in term in a minimal sense. What do I mean? I mean, because we live in a one of the pluses of social media and the pluses of the digital age. There are a lot of minuses, tons of minuses, and I've talked about a lot of them here. But the one of the pluses is that travel is never, is no longer any kind of excuse for not studying Torah. Men, women, doesn't matter. Everything is at your at your fingertips. There are myriads of shiurim in every language known to man. There are myriads of websites. Every single major text that in Torah, from Chumash all the way down to the latest responsa, are available, and many of them, and philosophy, are many of them are available in digital form and in English, or in French, or in Italiano, grazie a Dio, and in all kinds of other languages. So that issue, lo kol amar bebischa, at least that disadvantage, really no longer holds. At least as far as basic knowledge is concerned. And the truth of the matter is, people that travel for business, that's a question. Then becomes a question of how you use your time. Sometimes you get out of your immediate context, and it's hard to maintain your regular schedule. On the other hand, it gives you an opportunity. I've mentioned my dear, beloved, and tragically murdered friend, Rabbi Dr. David Applebaum, Hashem Yikom Damo, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. He founded the first private emergency room in Israel called Terem, Tipul Rifui Miyadi, immediate medical care. And in order to be able to pay his doctors properly, because doctors don't really pay, don't get paid really well here in Israel, he worked a deal where American-trained or English-speaking emergency medical professionals, doctors who worked for him here, would go and man private emergency rooms in the United States when they were most needed. When they were most needed is in July, because that's when the residents go off and there's nobody qualified to take care of patients. And in December, because non-Jews want to take off because it's their holidays. And, a Jew doesn't really care if he's going to be, working on Christmas or not. Why am I telling you this? Because David used his time. He used to go to this, I don't even know where it is. It's Gainesville, Georgia. If somebody can tell me where Gainesville, Georgia is, you're welcome to tell me. Because I have no idea, and I never remember to look it up on a map. But anyways, he would sit in Gainesville, Georgia, and he would, work as an emergency medicine doctor. He worked to run an emergency room. And then, when he wasn't, he would learn. And he wrote a sefer. This is sabbatical year. This is Shemitah year. He wrote a book about Shemitah. For some reason, it hasn't been published. And it's already 18 years since he was murdered with his daughter in a terrorist attack, but that's what he did. So travel actually can be a beneficial thing, and that whole line of understanding, I think may not be as relevant, or at least not necessarily so. I always tell you that one of the things about commentaries on Pirkei Avot is that often they are as much self-expressive as they are interpreted. In other words, they tell you as much about the concerns of the commentator and the times in which he lived, and Smirtasim will soon see, I'll be able to say he or she lived, than as what the words mean. So I'll give you two examples. I mentioned that most of the those who interpret this Mishnah or this phrase in the Mishnah say that the that lo kol ha-marbe b'schora machkim emphasize the fact that if you are overly involved in your business, if you don't set a clear limits, then you're never going to be able to become a scholar. But everybody's supposed to become a scholar to the degree of their, to the best of their ability. It's interesting, at the same time, that that assumes, as I said before, that making a living is a good thing. Making a living is a positive thing. Making a living is part of the obligation of every single Jew. So, okay. That being the case, there's a tension. There is a tradition, which is well known now from the Lithuanian yeshiva world, that one should actually, there is an ascetic tradition in Judaism, it's not, you know, it's not dominant, in which you say you have to do without. And there were those more pietist commentators who invoked Rabbi Akiva, again, Rabbi Akiva's statement that it is better to have nothing special for Shabbat in terms of food or its observance, rather than have to take handouts from the community. By which the person meant that, you know, one should absolutely live on a maximal minimum in terms of one's income and devote oneself totally to Torah. That's really not what the Mishnah says here. But obviously those who interpret it that way wanted to make very, very clear that there is a one strain of thinking in Judaism, which is ascetic, which is world. I wouldn't say it's not contemptus mundi, you know, where the world, where you disdain or hate the world the way you find in Christianity, but rather a question of minimizing individual pleasures to an extreme. Interestingly, I just recently discovered in the course of my studies of the Tanya that Lubavitch has a very strong ascetic withdrawal from the world and withdrawal from income, kind of trend to it, as opposed to other forms of Hasidut. But all right, that's just by the way. At the same time, okay. So that's a case where the words don't bear the meaning that is attributed to them, if those who interpret that way. But there's something inside them that they had to get their message across. That's the major point. Finally, I always I get a kick out of this. In the 19th century, there was a German rabbi, his name was Yisrael Lifshitz, and he wrote a very famous and very popular and really wonderful, lovely commentary of the Mishnah called Tiferet Yisrael, on the entire Mishnah. And he not only interprets the Mishnah beautifully and in elegant Hebrew, which is very accessible, and it's really, I very strongly recommend it. He also likes to go on these long sort of like excursi. He goes on these long digressions, and many, very often, they are actually of contemporary note. In other words, he talks about stuff that, you know, bothers him. In one case, he talks about the impact of nascent bacteriology for halacha. Don't forget, he lived in the 19th century at the time of Lister, when bacteriology was just beginning to become a thing. And on other occasions, he talks about politics. He's got all kinds of stuff to say. So because he's a person who's really out there, and he says what he thinks in terms of contemporary issues, he says, "Lo kol ha-marbe b'schora machkim." He says, you got to be very careful. He says, we're not saying that people who are not, people who are actually just involved in their professions and their businesses, that they're stupid, that they can't be smart. No. He says, first of all, any significant economic endeavor, whether it be professional or commercial, requires, and he uses the word haskalah, requires education, requires training, and leads to wisdom, and deserves respect. And one shouldn't, it's interesting what's bothering him, one shouldn't denigrate, one shouldn't demean, one shouldn't devalue or not value people who have experience, people who have life experience, people who know how to do things in their chosen careers. Lo kol ha-marbel b'schora machkim means that there are different types of wisdom, and all kinds of wisdom are valuable, but we're talking here about Torah wisdom in particular. And that's really interesting, coming from a guy who's living in Germany when German Jews are beginning to go to university and they're beginning to get out in the world, and they're reading not only Chumash but Schiller and Goethe and so on. So that and going to his concerts. So you're already, in other words, he sees this line and he says, you know, he feels he has to protest the credibility, the legitimacy of a nascent sort of modern Orthodox, if we call it, or neo-Orthodox worldview, which is very, very different, very starkly different than what we discussed until now. Okay, that is it for today. Next week we will talk about one of the most commonly cited and I think often misunderstood statements. B'makom she'ein anashim yishtadel liyot ish. If there's in a place where there are no men, try to be a man. In the meantime, this class has always, as always, for the last almost a year and a half, is being brought to you by the Tel Aviv International Synagogue, headed by the inimitable Rabbi Ariel Constantine. And you are welcome, invited, please, to share this year on social media. I'm going to be putting it up on my Facebook page. It's on my Facebook page already. I'll be putting it up on my story, on Instagram, on YouTube, and an MP3 version will be available on NYU Torah. Let me know what you think. Comment, please comment. What do they say on the Tikvah podcast? Let's push this community of ideas. I'd like to see us grow and expand the conversation. In the meantime, be well, enjoy a full week of no holidays, and we will see you next time.